Hey, what's going on, guys? Taxation is Theft, and we are back. I've got a special guest with me today, and we're going to talk about some pretty interesting subjects. So please welcome Pat Ruckert. How's it going?
Very well.
Awesome. Very well. So now I met you through a mutual friend, and we've had a few conversations. Most interestingly, I remember the first thing you said to me was, "You don't believe in taxation is theft." And I was like, "Okay, well, these are the kinds of people I like to have conversations with, because if you keep talking to the same people who agree with you on everything, then nobody learns anything, right?"
That's right. Especially in the political and intellectual environment of the country today.
Yeah, and I think it's I actually bring this up a lot. There's kind of like this stigma that it's impolite, or it's not socially acceptable to talk about politics over dinner, in public, at work, in these other places. And some people get really offended if you try to bring up any political topic. And that, of course, is why I think we're in such a mess, because nobody wants to talk about anything. Either they want to fight about it, or they it's forbidden to talk about, which are kind of the two extremes.
I would add to that is that most Americans today really don't know very much about anything, you know, and that is in large part why they don't want to talk about it, because they don't have the intellectual confidence in themselves that they actually know something. You know, they'll take something off Fox or off CNN or a slogan and that's about the end of it. But the Beyond slogans and really shallow analysis or view or rhetoric, you know, there is not much there in most Americans these days.
Yeah, it's true. And I think, I see that for a lot of reasons. For some people, they don't want to deal with it just because there's so much. They're on overwhelm and they don't want to deal with it. For others, they think pretty much everything that comes out of the TV is lies, which in many cases is true. You don't know what to believe. So I think people are just tired of trying to have to figure, you know, like, here's an example. You see something on TV, you say, "Oh, that's interesting. I'm upset about this and something should change." And then you go have a conversation with somebody, and the next thing you know, they're calling you an idiot because you told them something that you saw on TV. And it's like, "Well, wait, so was this not true? Did the news lie to me?" And it puts people in pretty difficult situations to want to talk about anything political.
Well, that goes to what I said already, that there's real lack of confidence in people actually knowing anything. And so then they just get scared.
Right? Yeah,
and then throw out a, you know, calling you a name or something.
Yeah. So you proposed a topic that I thought was interesting, because this is one thing that I guess I should say about it is, so I used to be completely politically ignorant. I wanted nothing to do with politics. I didn't have time for it. I wasn't interested in it. All these other things. And then 2008 came around, and I remember, as much as I tell people, I had my heart broken by Obama because he didn't live up to his promises when I voted for him the first time. That was when the big financial collapse hit, and that was when that's when I started paying attention to things and when I started getting interested. So you brought up the topic. Hey, let's talk about the upcoming financial collapse, which I've always thought is just around the corner since 2008. But let's talk about that. So what in your opinion is the next upcoming financial collapse?
Well, 2 days ago, September 15th, is the 10-year anniversary of the collapse of Lehman Brothers, which set off the 2008 banking financial collapse, which then, in a bipartisan spirit, the Congress first voted against the $800 billion bailout, and then Obama and McCain, the presidential candidates at the time, went into the Congress and Obama especially threatened the Black Caucus. You vote for this, you know, and then Congressman, I forget his name now, from Southern California, after the vote to actually pass the bailout, said, we were threatened with martial law if we do not pass this bailout, right? So that was the anniversary 2 days ago, right? But a month ago, on August 15th, was the 47th anniversary of what really began the collapse that we had 10 years ago and we're heading into again. But that was when Nixon pulled the plug on the dollar, broke the connection between the dollar and gold, and initiated a completely deregulated international financial system where no currency was stable, all were subject to speculation. And within a few months of August 15th, 1971, where previously over 90% of all international financial transactions had something to do with physical goods or actual trade or services, but within a few months, it completely reversed. 90% was pure currency speculation of international financial transactions. So what are we looking at now? Right. Well, I'll just read a couple of things from the last few days here. CNBC TV, September 11th, reporting on a Moody's Investor Service report. Quote, is another corporate debt crisis lurking, and honed in on the U.S. corporate debt, which in 2007 peak of corporate debt of $12.7 trillion, it is now $15.9 trillion. Worse, triple B junk, that is one little step above pure junk bond status, has gone from $700 million to $3 trillion of the $15.9 trillion debt is now junk bonds, right? And that's about one quarter of all bank lending, by the way, right? So New York Times, September 12th, the next day, the next financial calamity is coming. Here's what to watch. Corporate debt. Now, without a lot more detail, I'd give you just a couple more items. Italian economists a couple days ago warned the financial system is today more overblown than in 2008. And of course, the lesson from Lehman Brothers collapse has not been learned. He said we have several trillions in derivatives now, which is capitalization of few dozen times higher than global GDP, and most of that is collateralized financial leverage. Now, just to add a political side to this, because everyone knows, well, there's a hell of an attempt to remove President Trump from the presidency right now. It's a coup d'etat or attempted coup d'etat, and Willy Wimmer, who's the former deputy defense minister in Germany, in an interview a couple days, two or three, 4 days ago, said the removal of Trump from the presidency will put the world on a path to World War III. So the China, Russia, you know, other major nations have had over the last few days, you know, similar articles to that of the New York Times and the Bloomberg one, in terms of warning we're heading for a new crash. You know, student debt, for example, is now $1.5 trillion, right? You know, and most of that will never be paid. We know that, right? So something's going to crack at some point here. It might be Turkish or Argentine bankruptcy of major corporate and financial debt, because funds are just flowing out of those countries and their currencies are collapsing. Argentine currency collapsed 30% in the last month against the U.S. dollar. So vulnerabilities are all over the place. So I'll stop there on that side. That gives us something to go.
So there's a lot of interesting points that you brought up there. I think a lot of the things that you say, you know, like for example, there's one that you said, or you quoted someone as saying, if Trump were removed from the White House, that would start World War III. That I think that's almost kind of like an unpredictable, almost propaganda. I don't think that's really founded. But when you talk about all the debt, that definitely is like an actual, you know, tangible symptom of a pretty big problem. And so I've been looking at a lot of these debt issues, and you know where it comes from is it's always government tampering with monetary systems, which is one of the reasons I believe government shouldn't have power to do that. We shouldn't be using government-based fiat currencies, whether there's something like a gold standard or Bitcoin or something else that we can switch to. That solves a lot of the problem, because a lot of the lending comes from banks being able to, you know, use a fractional reserve system and lend out, you know, 10 times what they actually have in assets. But it's the government that says, like, so you know, if I had $1,000, I couldn't lend out $10,000, because eventually, you know, even if I were keeping my own accounts, eventually someone would come back and say, hey, I want my money, and I wouldn't have it. But what the government does is they say, well, we're going to insure it. So basically, you're allowed to make these extremely risky loans. You're allowed to lend out 10 times as much money as you have, but we're going to insure it, so it's okay. And the reality is, you know, the loans are still risky. Things do eventually collapse if things, you know, go wrong. And you end up with the government saying, oh, well, we said we're going to insure it, so we'll cover it. But the reality is they don't have the money to cover it. They have to borrow and print it. So it's kind of like, you know, the whole foundation of this system is built on top of, you know, this what I call fraudulent monetary system. That basically allows them to create money out of thin air. And not only are they creating it, they're creating it. You know, it's one thing if you just print a bunch of money, it causes inflation, which is one problem. But if you print the money and you distribute it, it's not as bad as if you print the money and distribute it and then say, but you all have to pay it back to me with interest, because now that much money doesn't even exist. So I think that's, you know, that kind of compounds the problem. What do you think about that?
Well, the in the last 10 years, what did they do, right? Well, they called it quantitative easing, mm-hmm. right? Where the central banks just literally, you know, they didn't print the money. They just
digitally
did a few clicks on the computer, right? But it's over $4 trillion. And what did the central banks do with it? They bought corporate debt in many cases worth virtually nothing, but mm-hmm. they paid full face value for it, right? And so they just pumped, you know, at least $4 trillion into the financial system. And it's sort of like Trump's tax cut, right? Because it was not actually, it did not include something that the Kennedy administration had, a investment tax credit type of element to it. It said, okay, you can just bring your money back here, right? And what happened to most of it? Something like 70-80% of both the corporate or the tax cut that they received and the money they brought back from overseas went into buying their own stock, which drove up the stock market for the last damn near a year now. And what went into investment in new plant and equipment to expand the real economy? Virtually nothing, nothing at all. And so I think where I'm going to divert from you is on this question of the way essentially way you put it is government, you know, does this, right? Whereas what I would say, there's two systems. You know, there is what we have now, a completely corrupt, virtually evil system that that drives populations into penury and poverty and destruction, which is what we've seen especially the last 10 years, but increasingly for about since 1971, almost 50 years. Right? Now, there is another system, and it is a government system that most Americans really don't have an idea of. It's called, in the 19th century, it was called the American system. It was created at the time of the founding of our nation and the adoption of the Constitution by Alexander Hamilton, his creation of a national bank, a national credit system, and a direction of lending that, as he stated in two of his reports to Congress, that the lending of money, in this case by the U.S. National Bank, which was the U.S. government bank at the time, you know, that all lending must have a means of repayment of the loans. Right? Now, that's what you absolutely don't have today. Right? You know, just giving out money to the banks, you know, it's called a loan, right? But there's no investment in industry, in infrastructure, in scientific development and research that actually does produce real wealth. Right? So it is that, you know, that's the alternative system. You know, that's what I represent in terms of the ideas that I put forward, and in my writings on infrastructure and other stuff.
And I think I agree with you on most of that. There's, you know, we do that is, you know, the fractional reserve system is, I guess it's, you really have it at two levels. You have the Federal Reserve doing this with the banks, and then you have the banks doing it with us. And the one with us is more of the fractional reserve system. The Federal Reserve kind of does it at another level when they lend to the banks. So I agree with you on that. But when I see things like, okay, so let me use your example of you have a corporation that says, let's say they have a lot of money overseas. They don't want to bring it back because it's going to be taxed, but now they get a tax break. So they're going to bring this money back, and they're going to use this money to buy their own stock, right?
Yep.
So what a lot of people will say is, see, they're investing this money in themselves, and so it magically just, you know, the 0.1%, 0.001%, these big corporation owners now took all this money and they just stuck it in their own pocket. But really, that's not what's happening, because if let's say they bring back $100 billion, and let's say it's Exxon, right? They bring back $100 billion, and the board of Exxon says, hey, we're going to take this $100 billion and we're going to buy back $100 billion of our own stock. Who are they going to buy that $100 billion worth of stock from?
Well, the other stockholders, obviously.
Exactly. And if the price is going up, then basically what they're doing is they're taking that money that was overseas, and now they're distributing it among whether it's individuals who are holding that stock, whether it's individuals who have money in their 401ks that are invested in that stock, and that's driving the price up. And because you can't, you know, no, you can't just buy stock and then that's it. There's for every transaction, there's a buy and a sell. So I think that money is actually going back into the economy, but it's kind of at an unseen level, because it's you see them buying their own stock, but you don't see, okay, who's selling the stock to them. And sure, there are some big banks who are going to profit off of that, but a lot of them, like, how do a lot of big banks get their money, especially investment firms, from their investors who deposit? And now, of course, this is all still built on top of that fractional reserve system, but I think it's wrong to say that they're keeping all the money for themselves and it's not going into the economy, when someone literally has to sell the stock back to them in order for them to buy it.
Yeah, well, I'll look at it a little bit over longer term. This is it's portrayed as the longest bear market or bull market in history. Right, it's been mm-hmm. going up and up and up. With, the Dow is over 20,000 now. It used to be called the Dow Industrials, but I don't think there's any industrial firms on it now. It's all it's Disneyland banks and financial companies, right? So, let's say the Dow went down to about 8,000, if I remember right, after the crash in 2008. It's now over 20,000, right? So that's doubled, almost tripled, right? So then we say, okay, what does that really represent? Does that mean that we've almost tripled the quality and amount of our infrastructure? Has the wages of teachers tripled? Has there been a tripling of investment in fundamental scientific research and development, the space program, of investment in research on fusion power, right? Have wages tripled? So it's really all money. It doesn't really represent something real that human beings could actually measure in their day-to-day lives, right? I think I'm a lot older than you. I'm 74. I grew up in the 1950s and became an adult in the early 60s, right? So it's really a completely different world we have then, right? At that time, my father's a construction worker, right? And so he could buy a new home. My mother did not work, two children. He'd take 2-3 weeks vacation a year, a new pickup truck every 3 years or so, full health insurance, and be able to save money, right, on one wage of a construction worker, right? And then I went to college and then university. My tuition at college was, $150 a year. My tuition at the university was $300 a year. And when I worked construction in the summer, I'd make my year's tuition in a week and a half, right? So, that was the norm in the period. The clerk, the retail clerk at Penny's, same thing, right? That's the quality of life they had, or the population had then, And we all know nobody can do that on one wage anymore. No family, right? That's the deterioration and destruction of the real, what I call, physical economy of the nation over the past 45, 50 years. And I'll just add one more point, and that is infrastructure, right? The infrastructure we depend upon today was built in the 1930s, the 1940s, and into the 1960s. I do a weekly, report on California water infrastructure and related areas, and I know the history very well. The state of California absolutely depended upon the Franklin Roosevelt Central Valley Project and the California State Water Project to be the state that provides half of the fruits and vegetables for the whole country and other nations too. Right? You know, but that was all built 50, 60, 70 years ago, and nothing's been built since. And that's why we have a water crisis in California now. Right? So,
yeah,
but no, stop.
I mean, so, well, let me ask you this, because, you know, I hear all the things you mentioned, and I agree with you that these are all problems. Of course, I blame the government for every single one of them, and I can walk you through, you know, how. But what I'm interested in is, what would your solution be, knowing what you know and, you know, knowing what we all agree on? Also, what would be your solution to fix all these problems?
Well, the little background, you know, I said I'm 74 years old. I became a political activist in 1967, and that was the year I graduated from the university, right? 1967, and that was the explosion of the Vietnam War. So for the next 3 years, I was an activist working to stop the United States mass murder in Vietnam. By 1970, I joined the Lyndon LaRouche Political Organization, and that's what I'm in today, you know, 48 years later. And what we put forward is a comprehensive policy for the world and for the United States. And that begin, you know, just to kind of summarize it in 4 points. One, restore the Glass-Steagall banking law, which was repealed in 1999 and did lead to the collapse in 2008. And then restore a national credit system where, as Alexander Hamilton put forward, where the investment, you know, both from revenue sources of the government and private investment is directed toward fundamental areas of building infrastructure, industry, the space program, research, development, infusion, that sort of thing, in real physical economy. And then thirdly, is you must sustain and maintain the well-being of the population, right? That means no attacks on Social Security, Medicare, and other government programs that are fundamental to the well-being of tens of millions of Americans today, right? You can't just cut things off, you know, unless you really want to kill people, right?
Yep.
And then fourthly, a great expanded scientific research and development policy focused on the space program and fusion, right? So that's what I would do, right? Is, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4.
So let's talk about scientific investment. So it's, you know, as you know, my opinion is to keep government out of everything. What I see, you know, the environment I'm in and where I work, I see a lot of money going into scientific research. It's true that, you know, a lot of it goes into for-profit things, but we also see, you know, there's investment into solar technology, everything from self-driving vehicles, which improves the economy, saves lives, you know, all these other things. We have a private company that's now launching test flights into space that hopefully they'll be able to take satellites up and everything for just a fraction of the cost of what NASA was doing. I see in the private sector a lot of this is really going on now. And you know, let's not even forget, you know, when we talk about even aerospace, the first airplanes were invented by private individuals. That wasn't a government venture. Television, radio, you know, the internet. I know a lot of people argue that the internet was created by the government, but
Al Gore did not do it.
and so I see, you know, most of the technology, and I'm not going to say government didn't invent anything. You know, they obviously did spend a lot of money on some specific things that would have benefited them. Mostly, in my opinion, mostly that would have benefited their war power. But I see a lot of the technology that we have today came from private investment, and I think that, you know, we do have. I mean, the government. It's hard to say, like, you know, you've got the private sector, because the government is like, there is no separation from the private sector and the government. They're all tied together so well. So, for example, you've got oil corporations who are lobbying to keep, you know, solar companies and clean natural gas and all these other things, fusion and fission and all these other things. They're, you know, they don't like that stuff because it takes away their profits from oil. But a lot of how they control that is through their controlling of government. They, you know, oil companies are able to keep their prices down by taking subsidies from government, which comes from taxpayers. But if you get rid of that, then the profit margin starts shrinking, and these companies are forced to raise their prices on gasoline, which means there's more of an incentive for the consumer to say, hey, I'm going to switch to natural gas, or I'm going to switch to solar, because it's not so cheap anymore, because the gas, the coal, these other things aren't so cheap anymore. So I think we'd see a lot more growth in some of these technologies if the government kind of stepped back and said, you know, hey, we're going to stop messing with the markets. We're going to stop messing with investments and regulations and all these other things.
Yeah, much of what you said is true. In fact, what is the fundamental driver of economic progress? It's human creativity, right? And that's individual. That is personal. Individual or creativity does not come from a group, right? It is discoveries by individuals who then communicate the discovery. You know, that's fundamental principle of science, whether it's Kepler and early 1600s discovery of the actual organization of the solar system, or Einstein 100 years ago with the completely overthrowing all of physics with his development of relativity, right? Which then led to the development begin mastering of nuclear processes, for example, right? You know, so that's individual discovery. And one thing on Einstein, which then gets at this creativity idea a little more, is he's asked, you know, well, what is your inspiration? How do you come up with these brand new ideas that never existed before? And he said, it's right here in my violin. It's in Mozart, right? That's what inspires me and allows my mind to be free to develop new ideas, right? So it's human individual creativity, you know. So I agree with you, you know, that scientific discovery is individual, and you know, call it private or whatever, that's fine, right? But it is, but we are, you know, social beings, and that individual discovery would go nowhere unless it's socialized and then brought into cooperative action to actually build something with it, right? You know, that, you know, so corporations do that, right? Which is a social structure, social, political, economic structure, right? But I'll go back, you know, back to the 30s again. And when you have then the power of corporations or banks, especially banks and trust funds back in the 20s and 30s, you know, that have control over electricity generation and distribution, as it did in the 20s and 30s, right? Then, you know, in 1936, 10% of U.S. farms had electricity, just 10%, right? Sweden had 90%. Japan had 80% of the farms with actually had electricity. Well, why didn't the American farms have electricity? Because private corporations owned the entire electrical power system. Excuse me. One second here. Okay, so Franklin Roosevelt, president then, you know, created the rural electrification organization, which by essentially executive direction allowed for farmers to create co-ops and then come to the government and borrow what is required for that group of farmers to both either create electrical power generation and laying the lines and bringing electricity to the farms, right? And they borrowed directly from the government at 2-3% interest, right? And over the next about 16, 18 years, by early 1950s, 90% of the farms by 1953 were electrified, right? But what did the private power companies say? You know, well, we're not going to run a line 20 miles outside the city to one farm, right? You know, if you want to do that, it'll cost you $10,000, you know, and farm income in 1936 is about $800 a year, right? You know, so, you know, $10,000 to electrify your farm. You know, well, what was the effect of it? Right?
Well, I think that really is the same. So you're saying a couple different things here. First, I think you compared it to, what did you say, Sweden, where they had 90%?
Yeah, 80% or so.
80%, okay. So Sweden is obviously a much smaller country than the United States. So it's easier for them to have, you know, to build a complete grid with a lower price. You know, like you said, dragging cables across, you know, so many miles might cost a lot of money. And we see that, and so actually the government's solution to that was actually not that. It was not to drag, it wasn't that the government said, we're going to do that same thing and drag the cables. It was we're going to lend you money so that you can create your own, basically your own generator in different places. Now, this realistically is, you know, I look at this and I say, in this capacity, government was sort of acting as a private company. That could have been a bank. It could have been, any group of investors who said, "Oh, we see a need in the market that they want electricity, so we're gonna go around and we're going to build generators and we're going to, you know, either lend them the money or rent them the use of it." And I think that you know, there would be a way for that to happen without government. My main issue with government is that if, you know, let's say the farms were like, "Hey, you know, we're getting along just fine here without electricity, so it's not worth it for us to borrow the money at, let's say, 5 or 6%. If it were 2 or 3, we'd borrow it. If it's 5 or 6%, it's not worth it to us. We're doing just fine here." And for them to say, you know, okay, so it's the interest rate is 5%. We're not going to borrow the money. We're just going to keep doing it the way we're doing it. But then for the government to say, because taxation is theft, where is the government's money coming from? And let's say they're stealing it from those very farmers. They're taking the farmers' money, and now they're saying, "Hey, we have all this money that we can lend to you. So if you want to borrow this money, you can build a generator." The reality is, whenever you have a government program that's giving someone money, the government doesn't produce anything and sell it for a profit. So that money has to have been taken from somebody else. And so when you have, you know, it's like we can all get together and we can give money to the government for these farm generators. And then eventually, but what's going to happen is the government has to pay its employees. It pays its congressmen extremely well. It pays all of its, most of its employees extremely well too. And eventually, like, we're going to give all this money to the government, and it's going to get passed down, you know, from hands to hands. And then they're going to charge interest on that money on top of it and give that to the farmers, when realistically the farmers could have just said, "Hey, we're going to charge you a little bit more, but we're going to be able to produce more food of higher quality. And we'll pay we'll pay a little bit more to the farmers instead of to the government. They're going to take that money that they earn, and they're going to pay a little bit more for this electricity. They're going to raise the money themselves, and they're not going to pay interest on it because they're not borrowing it from someone else. So it's kind of like every time the money changes hands, somebody else is going to make a profit. Meanwhile, you've got government is, you know, the people who create the generators, let them earn a little bit of a profit because they're contributing an actual value to the production of the food. For everybody else who's involved in that system, you know, the farmers, let them earn a little bit of profit because obviously, oh, my camera just shut off. Because obviously, you know, they're producing something of value, and that's helping the economy, and that's feeding people. So let them earn that profit. But then you have government, and what exactly are they doing? What's their actual role in this in producing this value? And the reality is all they're doing is they're taking money from some people, they're giving it back to other people, and they're taking half of it and sticking it in their pockets and keeping it for themselves. So the system that you described, it sounds like it actually works really well. I would just say let them borrow that money from somebody that's not government.
Yeah, well, the private power companies did everything they could to sabotage the Rural Electrification Administration, you know, literally through their the congressmen they owned, you know, that the political manipulation, but they also sent out crews to destroy the new power lines being put in by the co-ops, right? You know, and this went on for a couple of years or so before you know, further legislation, you know, literally castrated all these huge power companies that were financial trusts. They really weren't power companies, you know. But I'll switch it to one other example that I know very well. That's the building of the Grand Coulee Dam in Washington State. I don't know if you're familiar with it, mm-hmm. Right? But it was a dream that a handful of people had in Washington State, you know, back you know, as early as 1918 or so, and a few people really were fighting for this. But 1933, when Franklin Roosevelt came in, he said, "Okay, let's build it." Right, and through the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, which was a fund of $100 million or so at the time, which had been created by Hoover to bail out the banks in the first 3 years of the Depression, right? But Roosevelt took it and said, no, we're not going to bail out the banks anymore. You know, and it had the bank holiday, for example, you know, as soon as the day, literally the day he came into office, you know. But later, so it's in summer of 1933, he said, let's build the Grand Coulee Dam. And so the first funding for that came out of the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, which is already allocated monies by the Congress, and it was completed in 1941. The biggest, most massive construction project in human history, and it remained the largest structure built by human beings for another 30 or 40 years, right? And it took about 8 years to build, and it cost about $150 million total over those eight years to build it, which came from both the WPA and other of the agencies created by FDR in the New Deal, right, and also direct allocations by Congress. Now, so it cost $150 million to build. And as Alexander Hamilton made very clear, in that any government money that's loaned must have a means of repayment built into that loan. Right? And that's what's lost with all this stuff, you know, especially you focus on, right? You know, there's no means of repayment, you know, unless you're going to steal it from somebody, right? So, but, you know, so $150 million, and in the 70 plus years since the dam was completed, just direct revenues from selling electricity, right, has been in the billions. I think 20 years ago was over $4 billion, revenue just from selling electricity. So it paid for itself, right? It's owned by the government, and it sells the electricity, and that doesn't even count the irrigation side, right, which turned most of eastern Washington into a garden of production of fruit and vegetables, and wheat, so that's, and there's no way any corporation, any group of private individuals who could have ever financed and built that dam. And that's the same, from the Central Valley Project of California. The state, the private individuals had been talking about a huge irrigation project for the Central Valley of California. The 400 miles long and about 100 miles wide, of perfect Mediterranean climate, just needed water, right? So by the early 30s, the state of California said, we've got to build this, right? But that was the Depression. The state could never finance it, so the federal government stepped in, and it financed it, right? The project actually is never completed to this day in terms of all the elements of it, but it did create, the greatest production of fruits and vegetables on the planet. Right? It's incredible. So this leads me.
Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, it leads me to the conclusion I kind of want to make here, that is, economy is not really about money, right? It's about the mastering of nature, of discovering the fundamental principles of the organization of nature, of the universe, right? And then applying that knowledge to create the technology, the products, the processes that increase the living conditions and improve the living conditions of mankind, right? And so the purpose of the economy is not for you and me to have more money, because money in itself, it's just paper, right? You can burn it and you really don't change anything,
right? Yeah.
Right?
Can't eat
nothing.
It.
Can't eat it, So when we talk about economy, it is, how do we uplift humanity? How do we create a more productive workforce, more highly skilled, more encultured, especially, and generally improve, humanity's future? So when we talk about economy, we should always be looking 50, 100 years into the future, and that's what a nation can do. Individuals really can't do that except as they participate with others in saying, okay, 50 years from now, we're going to cover this country with maglev transportation system, maglev rail transportation systems, and completely eliminate, at least in intercity transport, trucking, get all the damn trucks off the freeway, and that's what we should have as our idea of what the economy is, and it's the cooperation, and you have to have a government that actually has that kind of idea, but we have not had a government like that since John Kennedy, okay? And so your entire lifetime, you've never seen a government that actually worked. I did when I was a young man. I saw, the space program, the Apollo project, and all that, right? You know, there's more than, you know, 500,000 people directly involved in putting a man on the moon. Right? You know, now most of that was contractors, right? NASA coordinated it and taxpayer money paid it. That's true, right? But it was nearly 500,000 people at Ford and GM and thousands of other companies that employed people, and the repayment to the economy was 10 to 1. For every dollar we put into NASA, you know, the actual economic effects was $10 of actual real generation of economic activity, and so, you know, I'll stop there. And,
all right.
You know,
well, so let fun. Me, yeah, let me give a couple thoughts in the opposite direction on that. So I'm a software engineer. I work with computer systems and all kinds of technology. And what I've seen is, so we have, you know, you talk about these big projects, and the way things are moving now in the computer science industry is, it used to be towards let's build bigger computers, supercomputers, giant computers, and really what things are going towards now is like a lot of people are understanding that even in designing smaller businesses, having a monolithic structure is not a good idea, because if one thing goes wrong, then you have catastrophic failure. So let's talk about this dam, for example. If this dam were to fail, have a failure where the power would stop being generated from it, how many people would that put out of power? Whereas if you would have, instead of building one monolithic, you built, 20 or 30 smaller, you know, hydroelectric plants in different places, if one of them goes out, it's not a big deal. The you know, you can get power from a different place. And so this is the same way technology is moving. We don't see so many big supercomputers being built anymore. We see more distributed systems, where, you know, banks can have one central ledger for like 1,000 different branches, or they can, if that central system goes down, or if the power goes out on, like, you know, one of the routes to that central system, that bank has to shut down. It's out of business, or not out of business, but it's out of commission until the power comes back up. But if that bank were to have its own ledgers closer at home, and if it were able to communicate with other branches directly, then if whatever that central corporate bank is that goes down, then, you know, the other banks can still operate without it. And so now when you talk about like a maglev system, sure, it's big, it's great, it might be able to transport a lot from one place to another on less fuel even. But what happens if something happens to one small part of that system that causes the entire one entire stretch of that track to be shut down? Versus what if we were to create, you know, take the roads that we already have and use individual trucks and have those trucks drive from point A to point B, but using self-driving trucks where they don't need to be manned anymore. And then plus we're already looking at electronic trucks that use electrical power instead of gas power. And these are amazingly more efficient and more powerful. So there's all kinds of, there's different solutions to everything, and having, you know, not focusing on monolithic and focusing on smaller compartmentalized makes a little bit more sense sometimes. And here's another example with like the maglev. So, let's say, for example, you have these giant ships coming from China, right? And they all have these containers. That ship can't go to Texas. It can't go to Ohio. It has to stop at the coast. And what happens? You take those things off and you stick them on little trucks, and the trucks take them to where they're going. Or you put them on a train, which is one big unit that can move a lot all at one time. But then, you know, the train station only goes so far. You still have to take it off and put it on trucks for local delivery. So there's still, whereas you might be able to say, okay, if we have a system of automated trucks that can drive, you know, self-driving trucks, you can have a system where they get on the highway, and now instead of each, you know, each driving as their own component where they have a lot of wind resistance, they can now, because they're self-driving and computerized and can be very accurate with their movement, you could have something where, you know, 500 trucks get on the highway and now they're back to back, which means there's very little air resistance for each one, because the air is now it's now moving like a train, and it takes, you know, as much energy to move as a train now, maybe not as little as maglev, but a lot less than a system that we have now. You're able to do that. But then when you get to the end of the highway where this truck now needs to go to a local delivery, you don't need to have all these giant machines that are now going to lift the container off of the train and stick it onto a truck. Now the truck just separates from the herd and can, you know, go its local route, and maybe it can find other trucks and do the same thing and save on air resistance there. So I think, and my point is not to say that this is a perfect system by any means, but my point is to say that, you know, yes, the government could have come along and done something that maybe nobody else could have done, but you can't necessarily say, because no one's psychic, if the government had not done that, would we still have come up with something that did change the world and have just as big of a change? We don't know. Could something better have happened instead that now we're not looking for answers anymore, because that question's been solved for now? We'll never know. It's kind of like, if Columbus didn't discover America, which that's not even the true story, but if Columbus didn't discover America, nobody else would have. It's kind of like saying that. The reality is, if government didn't do all these big projects, most likely somebody else would have. And I understand your argument too about, you know, you're talking about power companies going around and interfering with private individuals trying to build their own power supplies, and they, you know, that's a criminal act, and you know, that's, I agree with you, that's completely uncalled for, and that should be punished criminally. But I think, you know, government interfering by taking money from a lot of people and saying, this is what we think is best for society, we're going to spend all this money, it's they might make the right decision a couple times, but what happens when they make the wrong decisions? You end up with things like Vietnam, you end up with all these senseless wars, you end up with a lot of money going into building weapons of mass destruction. It's a power, you know, it's a power that they can either use properly or they can abuse. And we have no control over whether it's used properly or abused. And that's one of the biggest problems I see with government.
Well, that's the political question, right? I mean, this nation was created with the idea that we will have a representative government, that the people will participate in creating and running, monitoring, disciplining, and it will actually represent the people of the nation, right? And when you read the preamble of the U.S. Constitution, which I urge everybody to do a few times, I know in school we never read it, you know.
I remember reading that.
You know, but, you know, we the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, right? Well, you know, what does that mean? You know, well, we've created a union, but it's not perfect, right? And that the nation is a process of development and increasing, being less imperfect increasingly, right? That the purpose is to provide for the national defense and defend the general welfare of all the people and their posterity. Okay? And that's telling us that our responsibility as citizens is not just to our own personal interests today, but that we have a responsibility to give to the future generations unborn, you know, something better than what we found, you know, that was handed to us by those who built what we have, right? And that's why I really have made a call it a career, if you want to, but it's not really, but it, of this question of infrastructure, because in 1962 and 63, President John Kennedy inaugurated half a dozen or more water projects, mostly in the West, and in almost all the speeches he gave inaugurating them, he would say something like, what we're beginning with this project will not be completed for 20 years or more. It's not for our benefit today. It is for the benefit of those, who will come after us, right? And, of course, we've not had a president that has even come close to saying something like that, since Kennedy, right? That is the idea of our posterity, as the responsibility of us as citizens is to that posterity. And so I'm always oriented toward, how do we solve problems where you have, nearly a billion people on this planet that do not have access to electricity, right? And more than a billion who go to bed hungry. And in fact, when we look at the United States, you have 1/4 of America's children who do not have enough to eat at least a few days a month. Right? And when I was 20, 22 years old, I said to myself, within a decade or less, we're going to eliminate world poverty. Right? And that was kind of the spirit of the age, under President John Kennedy, right? and that created, in the minds of a lot of people like myself, young people like myself, that we really are going to change and make the whole world better, right? And I think that's really what economics, money, and finance, and discussion of government role and all that really has to orient toward. That's why I've done what I've done for 50 years.
So let me ask you this. I agree with that vision of the future that, we shouldn't have people in poverty. Although, I will say that is subjective, because there are people who live without electricity and they're perfectly happy with that. Without food, of course, is a different story, but, in different places of the world, what people want, some people can't imagine life without a mansion. Meanwhile, you have people in small houses or even living in grass huts, and they're perfectly happy with their living situation. But of course, if somebody's going hungry, that's pretty much a problem for anyone, unless they're, they've got some mental condition, but that's a problem for anyone. But so I agree with you on the world has all these problems and we should figure out how to solve them. I guess my main belief in that is when it comes to government is that, they pay for it with taxes. And I say, well, let's find a different way to raise the money for such a project other than stealing it from people. But to your point about, so if the government is supposed to be representative of the people, to how do you see, what do you think is necessary for that to change? Because right now, so many people are upset. I work with a lot of people in movements who want to end the drug war because they're arresting so many young people, minorities. They're creating wars and violence. They're killing innocent people. By opening the wrong door, there's really a lot of really bad things going on here, and most of the country wants to put an end to it, but nobody listens to us, even though it's supposed to be our government that's supposed to represent us. What do you think went wrong there, and how do you think we can possibly change that?
Well, the drug war, the drugs issue, 70,000 people a year die of overdose of opioids in the U.S. now.
Right, and most of the, a lot of those people are
that's opioids, right?
Right, and a lot of those are prescription opioids, and we have
absolutely.
Like in Colorado, once they legalized marijuana, people started using, which you can't overdose on. They're using that now instead, and their opioid overdose rates have dropped because of that.
Well, maybe, maybe not. But anyway, here's the point I want to make on it. You know, is that the drug cartels, right? The pharma industry, you know, deliberately addicted people to opioids, right? That, I mean, that's well documented. You know, and that is criminal, right? I mean, that is, you know, beyond criminal. Right? You know, if we had the death penalty for that sort of stuff, then it should be applied, you know, or maybe a Nuremberg tribunal, crimes against humanity,
but,
right?
But do you do that to the people who created the drug and distributed it, or do you do it to the people who are using it because I mean, if anything, those are the victims, but those are the people who are being locked up.
Yeah, yeah. No, no, I agree with you. You know, who should be locked up? Well, during the Obama administration, you know, Hong Kong, Shanghai Bank, you know, Citibank, Chase, you know, all the big ones, right? You know, made deals with the Justice Department. They did not plead guilty, but they pleaded no contest to billions and billions, hundreds of billions of dollars of drug money laundering from the Mexican cartels, you know, Hong Kong, Shanghai Bank, especially directly with the Mexican cartels, right? And so, no criminal charges, and obviously no trials or jail sentence for those who admitted that they broke the law in drug money laundering, right? You know, and it is that, you know, if you shut down the a guy named Acosta, who was the head of, you know, the head of the United Nations Commission on Organized Crime, International Crime, and Narcotics, right? He said it very clearly just a few years ago. He said after the 2008 collapse, the only reason the banks did not go under, you know, was not so much from the bailout, but from the laundering of drug money by the hundreds of billions of dollars, you know, the drug money from the cartels, you know, especially Afghanistan, Mexico, and a few others, right, kept the banks afloat, right? You know, so, I mean, the system is criminal, right? You know, and what you've hit on, especially in the drug question, you know, is the symptoms of a criminal system, right? And you got to just shut this whole damn system down, right? You know, just put the whole banking financial system into bankruptcy receivership, you know, and sort out, you know, the legitimate debts from the speculative derivatives, drug money laundering, and all zero that out, you know. And if bankers have to then become janitors, well, that's too bad, you know. Let them do so. You know, at least do something useful, maybe. but also,
what about our representation? Like, what? Because these are the people who are making the policies that are affecting all of this.
Yeah, well, you know, there's a revolution going on, you know, there's a from below. There is a revolt underway. We've seen it the last 2-3 years or so. The Brexit vote in Britain. Right, you know, the election of Trump. Right, I mean, he ran to destroy the establishment Republican structure, Republican Party structure, and he did. Right, and then he destroyed, with the help of Hillary Clinton, the Democratic Party structure. Right, good. You know, they both deserve to be destroyed. Right, now Trump's a pretty wild guy. You know, but he does represent that revolt from below, even though most of the supporters, and I'm a political organizer, so I talk to all kinds of people all the time, and I know that most of the strong support for Trump is fairly narrow, fairly shallow in terms of what people actually understand right? But it is a revolt. It is, you know, and it's continuing. Now, the and I'll say one more thing on it, which are somewhat different direction, that 2 weeks ago there was a conference in China, Forum on China-African Cooperation. 54 heads of state of African nations were in China. I mean, something like this had never happened before. Right? But did you see anything on the news on it in the U.S.? No, there's not a word. I mean, this is heads of state of 54 countries of Africa, and they're in China. Right? And it's accelerating the investments of the building of infrastructure and industry, roads and hospitals and everything else in multiple African nations. And for the first time ever, the poverty rate in Africa is going down, right? And this is all due to China investment in very few people know this, but the country that has the highest GDP growth annually for the last 3 years is Ethiopia. Right? You know, that's shocking. You know, Ethiopia, yeah. I thought that was a backward country. Well, it's over 10% annual growth rate per year of real economy, not financial transactions, but of uplifting of the population into hundreds of thousands of industrial jobs where people get a decent wage and they can actually support a family. You know, so there's something going on in the world that I like. So what we have to do in the United States, I mean, we effectively need a real revolution, you know, to destroy the existing system. You know, and you and I may disagree on what should replace it exactly, but I think we're on the same wavelength in terms of what the problem is and
absolutely.
And more what the result we want to see should be.
Definitely. You know? Well, I think we're at about time for today, but you said you have like a podcast. Do you want to give me your website and anything else?
Well, no, I write a weekly report on California water infrastructure and related areas, which goes more broadly into political and economic stuff too. And the website is californiadroughtupdate.org. And on Facebook, it's California Drought Report. You know, it's a weekly report I write. I have some videos on YouTube on presentations like the building of the Grand Coulee Dam I mentioned and California water projects and other that under Pat Ruckert under the on YouTube. You know, so
okay, cool, awesome. Well, it was great talking with you, and even though you don't think that taxation is theft, I think you're a pretty cool guy. You've got we definitely agree on a lot of things, and for my audience who is mostly the taxation is theft, you know, if you're watching this, this is what happens when you talk to people who might not agree with you on everything. You find out that there's actually a lot of common ground and interesting thoughts come out, and this is how we work together, even though we don't always think exactly the same. So that's my spiel for today. All right, Pat, again, it was great talking with you, and I'll maybe we'll see you again sometime.
Okay, a dialogue is really good.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and I think that's what we had today. Okay.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it.
I'll see you around.
Bye-bye.